Support for the World's Podcast comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/the world.
Apple's next problem today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The FBI says it doesn't need Apple's help to break into a terrorist suspect's phone, but that means the company now has another challenge.
Apple is sort of duty-bound to its users to go figure out what this flaw was and cure it.
Also, how Russia's Syria pullback could push President Assad to make a deal.
Assad may be compelled to accept some sort of political settlement that will probably circumscribe his authority while maintaining the ability to regain it over time.
Plus, a Guatemalan singer who wants more women in hip-hop.
We want the guys to see what women are doing by getting together. We want them to know that if we are all friends and we work together, we can do wonderful things.
Those stories and more today on The World. It's great to have you with us. National security versus individual privacy. That's where we want to start today, with the latest chapter in the tussle between the FBI and Apple. For months, the U.S. government tried to get Apple to help it break into the iPhone owned by one of the San Bernardino attackers. Apple said no, the Fed sued, but now the FBI says it's managed to get into the phone, and it may have gotten some help from an Israeli digital forensics company. David Sanger is a national security correspondent for the New York Times. He says it's likely that an Israel-based company called Cellbrite assisted the FBI.
We know this largely because on the day the FBI said it had an alternative, if you dug deeply into the announcements that the General Services Administration puts out about contracts that they have recently let, Cellbrite got a very small one with the FBI for help in unspecified computer programming issues. So it would seem to make sense that they were the one. But they have not said that they have the contract, and they have certainly not said what their technique would be. We suspect what it would be actually going into the hardware of the iPhone itself and burring down some glue that covers certain chips and getting at a certain code that might allow them to unlock the physical memory of the chip.
I mean, the U.S. government argued for months that this was impossible. What's your read on what was happening behind the scenes here?
Well, you know, there's going to be any number of conspiracy theories about what went on here. One possibility is that the FBI seized on the moment of the San Bernardino attacks and the horror of that to set a precedent in a pretty compelling case for why it is that you need to be able to get inside cell phones sometimes, and thought they would build up a lot of support for that. They did build up a fair bit of support, but they also built up and ran into an unprecedented amount of public opposition, most of it fueled by Apple accurately describing what the potential downsides in privacy were for users if this was the precedent that was set. It's also possible that the FBI got concerned that they were going to go lose their own case and decided it was better to get into the phone and pick another case to try to get at.
So the bowling pins are now set up for the next time someone gets a ball. Do you expect this method, the way they used to open the phone in the San Bernardino case, could it be used on phones in other cases in the future?
Well, I'm sure it's been used in the past, and I'm sure they will attempt to do it in the future. Apple will spend a lot of time trying to figure out how they got into this phone, because clearly Apple is sort of duty-bound to its users to go figure out what this flaw was and cure it.
It's kind of the worst-case scenario for everybody. I mean, no one comes out of this looking good, do they?
In some ways, no, but I think there's been a lot of good done by this entire event, because I think Americans who sort of vaguely understood the encryption debate but couldn't really get their heads around it until it was about something very concrete, now have a very concrete sense of it. And, you know, this gets at some core issues, the national security issues on the one hand, of the government's need to find a legal way in to any source of data, that if you get a legal subpoena, you've got to go comply with it. And people's sense that their iPhones are only phones incidentally, that, you know, you use it for the phone function, but fundamentally, it's your whole life. It's your medical records. It's the pictures of your kids. It's your texts with your spouse. It's your texts with everybody else. That anybody who's got access to the whole inside of the phone has access to your whole life. And that's very different than a wiretap.
Finally, what's your overall sense of Israel's high-tech landscape? I mean, is it as muscular as Silicon Valley?
It's quite good, and they're trying to make it better. They have compulsory military service, as you know, but they pick out some of the best and brightest students and put them in Unit 8200, which is the military unit that is basically the equivalent of the National Security Agency. People serve in it for their 2 or 3 years' service, but by their mid-late 20s, they get out with their Unit 8200 friends, and they go off and do startups. And you see startups in Israel all around the Unit 8200 alumni, and they're now actually building a campus for many of these startups outside of Tel Aviv. And so a lot of these companies are spin-offs of one of the premier surveillance and cyber agencies, intelligence agencies, and the one, of course, that did with the United States the attacks on Iran's nuclear centrifuges.
David Sanger, the national security correspondent for The New York Times, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
It's still unclear whether the San Bernardino shooters were inspired by ISIS. The group says it's behind many of the recent attacks in Europe. But in its strongholds in Iraq and Syria, it looks like ISIS is losing ground. Syrian government forces recently recaptured the city of Palmyra from ISIS. President Bashar al-Assad proclaimed it a major victory. It came about 2 weeks after Russian President Vladimir Putin announced the partial withdrawal of Russian forces from Syria. David Lesh is a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He's also the author of Syria, the Fall of the House of Assad. Lesh says there's no question Russia's involvement has boosted Assad.
You know, the key from his perspective, does he think that this gives him a carte blanche to not make any sort of concessions in the ongoing negotiations? Or does he really think in a delusional way that he can retake the entire country? You know, my hope is that he doesn't feel either of those two things, realizing his military limitations without the Russians. The modus operandi of Assad over the years, you know, has been to hang in there long enough until circumstances change that improve his bargaining position or even improve his relevance. And with their victory in Palmyra, it serves Assad's purpose as well as Russia's purpose in trying to paint the Syrian regime as being on the same side as all of the other anti-ISIS countries and groups.
Well, how did Putin's withdrawal of Russian forces change the equation for Assad?
Well, I think, you know, Putin's decision to reduce the military footprint in Syria is in good measure a diplomatic salvo aimed right at Assad. You know, the way the Syrian government scurried around to make it sound as if there was a joint and coordinated decision suggests it was not. The only way I think Putin can claim the type of diplomatic victory he's really looking for is for there to be some sort of political settlement that, in perception terms, he brought about that may or may not result in removal of Assad. Probably not. But Assad surely sees the writing on the wall in this regard because he knows he cannot further improve his military position without Russia, as Palmyra showed, yet he does not have the manpower and resources to do it on his own. So I have to think that he realizes he must engage in a political settlement process, at the very least to satisfy Putin so that Russia will selectively come to Syria's aid when needed. But in a typically Syrian way, the Syrian government will drag out the process as long as possible. They'll say no 49 times until they say yes on the 50th time, making the process gut-wrenchingly complex and frustrating. But I think that Putin has put Assad on something of a diplomatic island. And I imagine Assad and his advisors are trying to figure out a way to catch a lifeboat off of it. You know, Assad may be compelled to accept some sort of political settlement, allowing for the appearance of a devolution of power while maintaining the ability to regain it over time.
David Lesh, when was the last time you actually sat down with Assad?
In 2009. I've been told that he has not liked some of the things I said, and perhaps the title of the book, The Fall of the House of Assad, was one of the things he didn't like. So he's vetoed any attempts by me to meet with him personally. However, I'm still meeting with Syrian officials in Damascus and Beirut from time to time.
With your perspective on Mideast history, have you ever suggested to them you might want to start thinking about time to go because, you know, hang in there as long as possible scenario that kind of ended?
Yeah, well, I sent Assad a letter suggesting that he make the concessions necessary to meet the protesting at the time and set a term limit for himself that will lead to him leaving power. He did not follow my advice, obviously.
If Assad continues to drag the process out, okay, so he remains in power. That's one thing, but it's another thing entirely for him to be the leader of an actual nation with a government, with services. How does Assad see his future, do you think, when we're talking a country that really is non-existent right now?
That's an excellent question. And this is where being in this presidential bubble, they underestimate the amount that the Syrian people have moved on. You know, they've been voting for people. They've been running things. You know, I remember one leading Syrian opposition figure who is now dead, but he talked to me in late 2012. And I asked him, why are you doing this? I mean, this life of deprivation and death surrounding him and constantly moving around and hungry and all of these things. And he said simply, because I've heard my voice for the first time. Because in the previous situation before the uprising, almost everything was controlled. And once people hear their own voice, it's very difficult to go back to any other situation. So unless they really see the light and therefore consent to some sort of managed transition that leads to an actual decentralized political system, I just don't see how Assad can rule over this mishmash of areas that is now Syria.
David Lesh is a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He's also the author of Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Thanks very much for being with us, David.
My pleasure.
It's that time of the year when I can start thinking about lobster rolls. I mean, who doesn't love a good lobster roll? I'll tell you who doesn't love them. Sweden. But this isn't really about the rolls. Sweden wants to stop live American lobsters from being imported into Europe. This month, Sweden's Environment Ministry asked the European Union to ban imports of North American lobster. They're hoping to prevent lobsters from clawing their way into European waters and, they say, spreading disease. Chris Vrisamo is the owner of ABC Food, one of the largest seafood importers in Sweden. So more than 30 American lobsters, I gather, have been found in Swedish waters in recent years, Chris. How do people think they got there?
Reason is, you know, you could say the mishandling from other wholesalers on the West Coast. The rumor is that they tried to hold lobsters, and probably they didn't have any facility or any tank or anything. So they put them in the sea in some net, and then lobster escaped. But it's only the West Coast, a part of Sweden, where these North American lobster can survive.
And why do people have a problem with North American lobsters in Swedish waters?
Because that part of Sweden, we have also European lobsters, or we call them Swedish lobsters. And problem is that if we had American, North American lobsters coming into that water, maybe it will be like mixed up, like a hybrid. And also maybe some other disease maybe could be on the shell.
I gather, Chris, that most of your business comes from importing live lobsters from the U.S. So how big of an impact would this ban have on your company?
I guess it's like 75%. I mean, I'm trying to work on common sense. And I also try to work now with these people that like to stop this proposal.
So do you think an outright ban is too drastic?
I think that is very much too drastic. I get a little frustrated when I talk about it. And when I think about it, I think it's so very stupid. So we like to have, number one fixed holding facility. Also, number two, like direct import by air. And number three is no live counter sale. That is also important.
Could this ban be actually good for the market for European lobsters, for Swedish lobsters?
Not at all. I can't see that the ban could be any good for anyone. I have heard also some suggestions that it could be good if we buy cooked lobsters. But we are like a food country and culinary country, and I think that's a couple steps back.
Yeah, you don't want to have your lobster pre-cooked. Let me turn to your foodie sense for a moment. What tastes better, North American lobster or Swedish lobster?
I can say that they are on the same, you could say, level for me. And I can also say that I'm working with it, so I don't eat so very much lobsters.
So you're surrounded by lobsters so much you can't even appreciate the taste anymore.
You know, we talk lobsters, work with lobsters, so it's just that we like also Swedish meatballs.
Of course you do. Chris Vrisamo, owner of ABC Food, one of the largest seafood importers in Sweden. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a Guatemalan hip-hop artist tackles machismo head-on here on The World. Getting through high school and graduating can be hard, but it's even harder for kids from low-income immigrant families. Often they're asked to earn money to support the family or take care of sick relatives, and that means their schoolwork can suffer. But KUT's Kate McGee shares the story of one second-generation student in Austin, Texas, who is on track to graduate despite the odds.
Seventh grade was a pivotal year for Violet Jimenez. It's when she started her first job working as a clown.
I did birthday parties for little kids and weddings. And, you know, one of the jokes we always had is we do birthday parties, we do weddings, we do quinceañeras, we do divorces, we do funerals.
It was also the year she started playing the viola. Violet, now 17 and a senior, loves playing music. It's why she commutes 40 minutes into Austin every day to attend the public school district's Fine Arts Academy. She's in the school's orchestra and starts her morning at rehearsal. Statistically, the chances that students like Violet finish high school and go to college are low. Her parents are undocumented and divorced. They didn't graduate high school in Mexico. Violet grew up poor with an unstable home life and a negligent father who had custody of her and her sister.
When I first started like doing orchestra or, you know, things like that, my dad always be like, oh, you're probably going to end up quitting eventually. So that's always been the mentality in my family. And so it's really hard to want to, you know, try to be successful.
Growing up, Violet says she and her sister were often left home alone. She eventually started working so she could pay for her own food and clothes. She says this is what she told her parents.
If you're not going to take care of me, then I'm going to take care of myself.
Throughout high school, Violet has balanced schoolwork with practicing the viola and multiple jobs. She says her junior year was the toughest when she helped her mom clean businesses while also working at a fast food restaurant.
You know, I'd cry at night because it get to the point where it's so stressful. And dropping out has crossed my mind. But, you know, I mean, obviously you're not thinking straight when you're thinking that, because what are you going to do when you drop out? Work at Burger King? I mean, I'm sorry, but that's not the kind of life I want.
But not all high school students realize they should stay in school. And realizing that is tougher if you have foreign-born parents in the U.S., when chances are 8% that you'll drop out of high school, according to the nonprofit Child Trends. For Violet, having a support system has helped, and she found one at Breakthrough Austin, a nonprofit. It works with first-generation college students for 12 years, from sixth grade on up through college. While teachers, counselors, and schools can change every year, Breakthrough is different because of that consistent guidance.
We can meet with a student and just know them for a length of time. The duration of the program, I think that makes it really special.
That's Zakia Kareem, Violet's counselor at Breakthrough. Last year, the program served more than 1,000 students in the Austin area. Violet applied to the program through her middle school. Ever since, she's had a Breakthrough counselor check on her weekly. Breakthrough also offers counseling and summer academic courses and helps families with college applications and financial aid paperwork. But when you're dealing with more than 1,000 students and counting who are working or taking care of their family on top of school, it can be challenging to keep students focused.
But I think it is hard when you're having a conversation with a student about planning for the future when right now they're living in the day and their reality is, I've got to have this job because I've got to, you know, pay for this thing that's really important for me to have right now.
Zakia has worked with Violet for several years now.
I met her when she was in middle school, so I kind of got to know her a little bit. And so because of that, there's several people who know her really well. And so we can all advocate for her. We can all check in with her. It's nice to have adults who know you.
She's helped Violet through some tricky school transfers when her home life got rocky and made sure Violet stuck with the school that offers the orchestra she loves.
You need that motivation sometimes. And at least for me, you know, like, my parents don't do that. They don't do that at home. I have to do it myself. And sometimes when you're doing everything on your own, you don't want to keep trying. Breakthrough is like my second pair of parents because they're there to tell me that if I'm messing up, I'm messing up. If I need to get better, I need to get better. But if I'm doing great, they'll tell me too.
For Violet, the encouragement helps. She still works 3 nights a week, cleaning businesses with her mom, changing trash cans, scrubbing toilets. But she doesn't live with her dad anymore, and she doesn't work at the fast food restaurant. That's one less job for now. But Violet still needs to save money for private viola lessons, new strings, and her next challenge, paying for college. For The World, Kate McGee, Austin, Texas.
Kate's report is part of our ongoing look at the lives of immigrant students in the U.S. You can see all of those stories at PRI.org/droppingin.
nada hay demasiado humo, ansias de consumo, te sacan el zumo para exprimirte y sacarte todo el dinero antes que te paguen, ya debes todo el sueldo.
Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about the woman behind this music. She's Rebecca Lane, a hip-hop artist from Guatemala. Lane calls herself a daughter of Guatemala's civil war in the 1980s, one of the reasons why she raps about social justice. Right now she's on a tour with other female artists through Central America and Mexico. The tour is called Somos Guerreras, We Are Warriors. It started in Panama back in January and has been working its way north since. Lane says the tour has several objectives.
The first one was doing shooting a documentary about women and hip-hop through Central America and some cities in Mexico, and also doing workshops and getting to know the girls doing hip-hop in Central America, women doing graffiti, doing DJing, B-girls, rappers, MCs, beatboxers, and we are also making our concerts, our presentations.
No, you're not going crazy. That's Mandarina, the house cat you heard in the background. To keep costs down, Rebecca Lane and the other rappers on the tour are staying with people they know, and sometimes they're cats. We caught up with her in Merida on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Lane says Somos Guerreras is about challenging machista stereotypes about hip-hop and rap in the region.
Like the hip-hop culture in Central America and in Latin America in general is like in these hoods where there are a lot of social violence. So among us, we reproduce the violence. So we also want to change this. And I think that women are actually helping hip-hop evolve and given this new approach to what hip-hop culture can be. It can be loving, it can be without competition, it can be, you know, for building up the spirit of people approaching hip-hop.
This is Rebecca Lane's song called La Mer. It's about surviving domestic violence. Lane says her documentary will be ready in November.
Lleve los despojos de lo que tenías guardado. Tu beso salado es el más sagrado, relicario de miles de almas de desamparados. De todas las lágrimas que se han llorado, todas las cartas que van sin destinatario, toda mirada que se pierde al horizonte, desequilibrio que ha perdido su norte. Deja que te cante en el oído su canción eterna.
Music from Guatemala's Rebecca Lane. Apparently, no cats in the recording studio. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. France gears up to host two major sporting events this summer, the Tour de France and the European Soccer Championships. The main concern? Keeping everyone secure.
It's easier to make an attack than to prevent an attack. So, of course, there is no absolute security.
That's still ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Molenbeek, it's a name we've heard a lot lately, especially since the bombings in Brussels a week ago. But even before that, this district in Brussels had some notoriety. That's because Molenbeek is home to many Muslims and first and second generation Belgians. That includes some of the men who carried out the Paris attacks in November. Reporter Adeline Sia recently visited Molenbeek, and she met a woman there who wants to paint a different picture of her neighborhood.
Shazia Manzoor has lived in Molenbeek for most of her life, and she's proud of it. That's one reason she's dismayed by the hundreds of TV crews coming through here in the past 4 months, painting her neighborhood as a den of terrorists. Nicknames like Molenbeekistan don't help, and she says it makes people here feel angry and shamed. Manzoor was born in Pakistan and arrived in Belgium with her family when she was 2 years old. She's 43 now and deeply invested in her community. In 2012, she became the first Pakistani-born woman to be elected city councillor in Molenbeek. She says growing up here, things were good for her family. All these problems of radicalization and extremism we had never heard about. I would almost say that we lived in the world of the Care Bears here. It was extraordinary. And it was like this until very recently. She says she began to notice changes about 5 years ago, though they probably started long before that.
Il y avait un malaise, il y avait un mal-être. On ressentait ça effectivement.
We began to notice a sense of malaise and desperation in people's lives, she says. Most young people are unemployed, so they hang out around the streets in groups. And it made people feel uncomfortable. It happened slowly, but we did notice it. Still, like many others, she was shocked by the links between some of the Paris attackers and Molenbeek. So she wants to do whatever she can to show another side of her community. She took me on a short walking tour. We walk past the heavily guarded police station, and she points out a newish playground in a small park nearby. Past narrow streets lined with modest homes, we arrive at an open square with a cafe on the corner. A group of about 20 people, speaking Arabic, are sipping coffee at outdoor tables. I point out to Manzoor that all of the customers are men. Well, let's say that culturally speaking, Muslim women don't go to the cafe, she says. So you could be in a cafe in downtown Brussels, but here, a woman sitting among her fellow countrymen, it's still frowned upon. A few blocks on, we reached the local cultural center housed in modern offices in an elegant old brick building. And Manzoor runs into a friend.
Ici, toi, ici!
Angela Longuin runs special outdoor events at the center.
Bientôt, on va voir Molendance, qui est sur la voie publique.
We're going to have Molendance here soon, she says. It's a dance festival. And then theater. It's really diversified. Further on, we get to the main shopping street here, Chaussée de Gand. Manzoor says in the past few years, she's seen more and more hipsters shopping for bargains here, from clothing to pots and pans. I don't see many shoppers, so Manzoor explains that's partly because of Friday prayers at the mosque, but also the attacks in Brussels and Paris have kept people away.
Voilà la plupart des commerçants de la Chaussée de Gand qui sont en général donc des Belges mais d'origine marocaine.
Most of store owners here who are Belgians of Moroccan descent are affected economically, so the community is stigmatized. Manzoor has a lot on her mind lately. She's a moderate Muslim, she says, like many Pakistani Belgians in Molenbeek. She doesn't cover her long brown hair. And the idea that her neighborhood might seem risky for non-Muslims to venture into bothers her.
Je n'ai jamais eu aucun souci si en fait à Molenbeek et parfois je me demande si c'est le fait que
I've never had any problems here in Molenbeek and sometimes I wonder if even though I am Belgian my appearance seems foreign. My hair, the color of my skin, is that the reason no one has ever bothered me here? And do Belgians of European background get in trouble when they come here? Of course, there is this whole aspect about the attacks, I understand. But once again, why are we getting blamed for it? As she struggles to answer these questions, Shazia Manzoor says she knows her role now as city councillor isn't just to help local constituents, it's to reach out to the rest of the world. For the world, Adeline Sire, Molenbeek, Brussels.
The Brussels attacks, coming on the heels of the ones in Paris, has parts of Europe on high alert. And France will soon be facing two more huge security challenges. This summer, it's hosting both the Tour de France cycling race and the European Championship soccer tournament. You may remember that back in November, suicide bombers targeted a game in France's national soccer stadium, the Stade de France.
I was in Stade de France, in fact, during the attack. But, you know, I was not too far from François Hollande, and we have just understood at the half of the game what was going on, because during the game there is no news and the phones are not working.
That's Pascal Boniface. He directs France's Institute of International Relations and Strategy. I asked him what's being done to prepare for the European Soccer Championships this summer.
Anytime you have a sports, worldwide sport event, it's a would-be target for terrorism. And so the most important budget is for security.
What will the money actually go to? More police, newer technology, what
more
kind of
police,
things?
More police and private also guards, many more people securing the stadium and the access, and also more information and security. Of course, to be frank, the security leaders won't tell in advance what they are doing, because it's secret, to be efficient. But just the number of people securing the stadium and also the fan zone will be much higher than it has been planned in the beginning. But since the beginning, the security was the number one goal.
Is there any specific evidence of a threat, a credible threat against the European Championships that you know of?
No evidence, but just everybody is fearing that, because you have all the camera. The world will be watching the Euro. Everybody wants to be there, and so it's a specific target.
How is the overall threat likely to affect how people watch the matches?
I don't think we will see. For example, we will have a match today against Russia, and the stadium won't be full. But it's a friendly game, so it's different. And I will guess that when the Euro will launch, everybody will be there. Everybody will be there because both foreign and French fans want to be in the stadium or in fan zone.
So there are the European Championships. You also have the Tour de France, the bicycle race this summer. It's the biggest spectator sport in the world. I mean, with any of these events, can you really keep them safe?
As you know, there is no zero risk in this world. And anybody could go in the subway in any place, in any city. It's easier to make an attack than to prevent an attack. So, of course, there is no absolute security. But both in Tour de France and in Euro, the responsible of security feel comfortable that they are in a position to prevent any attacks. But, of course, nobody could tell that there is no attacks in any place in the world.
Just how important is Euro 2016, the soccer championships, for France at this time in terms of morale and in terms of just keeping this event kind of normal?
Yeah, you are right. Euro is very important for the bid to host Olympic Games in 2024. And if the Euro is doing well, it will reinforce the file for France to receive to host Olympic Games, and the decision will be taken in 2017. And as you know, in France, the moral is not very high. A good Euro and a good prestation of our national team will reinforce the spirit of the nation and will give more confidence to French people. Some people have proposed to cancel the Euro because it's too dangerous. But if you have done that, you could not do anything in France. You have also to cancel the concert, the demonstration, and any place in which people are gathering. So the best decision, and the only one to take, is to say no to fear and to keep the Euro just and to improve security measures.
Will you be at the opening match?
I hope so. I am waiting for my tickets, but I hope that I will be there.
Pascal Boniface, director of France's Institute of International Relations and Strategy. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have no doubt Pascal will get tickets for the opening match. Going to the game is probably the best cure for fear. That and just thinking positive outcomes. I was reminded of positive outcomes when news broke yesterday about a shooter in the U.S. Capitol. Not entirely a positive outcome in the end, but at least it wasn't the worst-case scenario either. And again this morning when I heard about the man who had hijacked an Egyptian plane going from Alexandria to Cairo. The hijacker had the plane fly to Cyprus instead. He was wearing a fake suicide belt. Eventually, he turned himself in. All of the passengers escaped unharmed. But for me, as I rolled out of bed this morning, the initial headlines sounded too familiar. Egypt Air, a hijacking, soft targets. This is not going to end well, I thought grimly. But then it did, a positive outcome. Maybe it's as much as we should expect these days, but it's still welcome, all the same. Think back to the protests across the Arab world in 2011, the Arab Spring. Popular movements brought down regimes from Tunisia to Egypt, from Libya to Yemen. But we did not hear much about protests in the region's wealthiest country, Saudi Arabia. But that doesn't mean they didn't happen. This is from video footage recorded by Saudi activists as part of a new film showing a side of the Saudi kingdom few outsiders get to see. James Jones directed the film, and it gets its U.S. premiere tonight, courtesy of our partners at PBS Frontline. It's called Saudi Arabia Uncovered. James Jones, the fact that that footage was shot by Saudi activists, what does it tell us about foreign correspondents' ability and access to tell the story in Saudi?
Well, it's severely limited. I mean, some journalists do get visas, but they're given a minder by the government and they're restricted in their movement and who they can talk to and what they can see. So our film really relies on a kind of underground network of brave activists who have filmed life in Saudi Arabia, starting with the protest back in 2011, but continuing right up to the present day, you know, filming everything from public executions to religious police patrolling the streets, harassing people, to everyday acts of violence against women on the street.
Yeah, tell us more about that network of underground activists and what they do with cameras and just what kind of risks they're running.
Well, the risks are huge. You know, people go to prison for posting a tweet critical of the government. You know, everyone is aware of the punishments they could face, but that hasn't stopped them.
Even in prison, activists are videotaping the conditions there. I mean, nobody's been caught doing that?
Right. I mean, the prison clips that we have in the film really shocked me. One activist called Raif Badawi, who was a young blogger, had posted quite mild criticisms on his blog of the government, more specifically Islam, but not calling for the overthrow of the government or anything extreme. But he was punished with 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes. And it was in his prison that the network managed to smuggle in mobile phones and then filmed the kind of horrific reality of life in there.
We meet several people who've been arrested by Saudi authorities in your documentary. Which person's story did you find the most compelling?
I think the story of the 17-year-old protester, Ali Nimr. He comes from a prominent Shia family in the East and was involved in those street protests in 2011 and 2012. But he was a schoolboy, and in February 2012, he was arrested, aged just 17, and then charged with treason. And the punishment for that is beheading followed by public crucifixion.
He has not been executed, though, has he?
He has not, although his uncle was executed on the 2nd of January this year. He was one of 47 men killed in one day, the largest mass execution since 1980.
His uncle being the famous Shia cleric, correct?
He's seen as a kind of rabble-rousing cleric, and he, you know, much more than Ali, I would say, was seen as the threat. But Ali was kind of caught up in this political game.
I was also very impressed to meet Lujain Hatloul, a woman activist who's well known for driving a car. And I think people in the West kind of thought, well, that's a very interesting and almost entertaining form of activism, a woman driving a car. But we really see kind of what she's up against in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Lujain is an amazing woman. She's incredibly brave. And as you say, it seems like a simple act to us to just drive a car and film yourself doing it and post it online. But she did that in late 2014 and was arrested and treated as a terrorist.
I mean, she's determined to keep fighting for change in Saudi Arabia. What's at stake for her and her safety doing that?
She knows the risks and she gets a lot of threats for the work that she does. But she's a strong believer in Saudi Arabia. You know, she's not calling for the overthrow of the monarchy, anything like that. She's wants kind of moderate progressive reforms, and she kind of buys into the system. And one of the things we feature in the film is the recent municipal elections in which for the first time women were able to vote and stand. And so, you know, she buys into that. She thinks that these small steps are significant, and that's the way that Saudi Arabia will be reformed.
How many people in Saudi Arabia would you say are upset with the monarchy, the fact that it even exists? I mean, can you put a percentage on it?
It's really hard to say. I mean, it's a question we all want to know the answer to, but there is no effective polling inside Saudi Arabia. I think it's fair to say that it is a conservative country and people feel strong allegiance to the rulers who are tied to the kind of religious establishment. Having said that, it's a very young country. You know, most of the population is under 30 and they have access to the internet. They're more aware of the outside world. They're seeing these kind of clips of abuses going on. So I think it's a very quickly changing society, and that's one of the many threats to the Saudi kingdom.
James Jones is the director of Saudi Arabia Uncovered, airing tonight on PBS Frontline. Thanks very much, James, for your time and telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
This is The World. I love the woods. They're a great place to leave everything behind for a while. But for millions of people around the world, forests are more than just recreation and meditation. They're sources of food, clean water, clean air, things that communities around them need to survive. Many forests in India, like other places around the world, are in trouble. But in one community in eastern India, a group of women has taken the lead as guardians of their local forest. And as Sam Eaton reports, the effort is making a difference.
Even the monsoon rains don't keep the women of Gundarabadi, a tiny tribal village in India's eastern state of Odisha, from patrolling the nearby forest at dawn. Armed with sticks and machetes, they file through rice fields and onto a muddy path that leads into 500 acres of wooded hills, a procession of umbrellas and brightly colored saris. They're here to ward off intruders, but one of the women suddenly veers off the trail and starts digging among the leaves. She returns beaming, holding something that looks like a sweet potato. It's called kadaba, says Janha Pradhan. And because it's wild, she says it packs more nutrients, keeping her strong and healthy. She says by eating foods from the forest like this every day, the people in her village never get sick. An oasis of health in a region plagued with malnutrition and poverty. The relationship of this village with its forests goes back centuries, but the land has actually been owned by the government since British colonial times. Now, for the first time, residents have a chance of securing official rights to the forest, a forest that might not even exist without these women and their daily patrols. They've caught someone, my translator tells me, as we run to catch up with the women in front. They've surrounded three men loading freshly cut timber into a three-wheeled auto rickshaw, poachers from another village. As the women scold the men, my translator fills me in.
He has some celebrations going on at his place, so he needs some wood, and that's why he came down to collect. And they're angry because that person never had took any permission from them.
The men are paraded back to the village to face the village committee, which will decide their fate. The women later tell me that if I hadn't been there with my camera and microphone, they would have beaten the men with their sticks. But instead, they get off with a stern warning. Not long ago, the women who patrolled this forest would have also been considered trespassers here. Earlier in the day, we passed heavy stone markers laid down by the British in the 1800s when the government declared these forests its own. But now, under India's landmark Forest Rights Act, tribal villages can claim title to their ancestral lands, totaling some 150,000 square miles of forest all across India. That's an area almost the size of California, making it one of the largest land reforms in India's history. That is, if it's actually carried out.
There's no commitment to even making the people aware of the law.
Madhu Sareen led the grassroots effort behind the law. But she says nearly a decade later, not even 2% of those land rights have been granted. And as India's economy surges, she says state-owned forests continue to fall to industrial development.
Coal mining, iron ore mining, bauxite mining, huge hydro dams.
Today, as many as a quarter of India's districts may be embroiled in conflicts with local communities over land rights. Sareen says the Forest Rights Act gives those same communities a much bigger stake in fighting to keep their forests standing. And she says it's women who are taking the lead.
Because the status of women, you know, in the forest-based societies is so linked to their role in the common property of the forest. Once that's gone, the man will still go and get some wage work or whatever. The woman, she has nothing.
That kind of loss motivates the women of Gundarabadi. Janha Pradhan cooks a curry from the tuber she harvested in the forest this morning. She says 30 years ago, when the men from her village were in charge of protecting the forest, it was nearly barren from overuse, providing little wood or food. Then a series of devastating droughts hit the region. Pradhan says at times families would only get a handful of rice. Mothers, she says, would feed their children but go hungry themselves. That's when the women organized to restore and protect the forest. They banned goats from the land to allow the trees to regenerate. Anyone needing wood had to get permission from the village committee. Men were no longer allowed to carry axes into the woods. Sarojini Pradhan, another member of the patrol, says when men were in charge, they would fight over the rules, often allowing illegal loggers to get away. But she says after the women began patrolling, the number of intruders dropped to nearly zero, and the forest quickly began to flourish again. Even the men I spoke with here credit the women for the dramatic reversal. Today, the forest again helps produce clean drinking water, a natural fertilizer for the village, which in turn has helped dramatically boost crop yields. It's an invaluable buffer against hunger and an increasingly unstable climate. But those hard-earned benefits remain precarious until the village secures official title to the land, which right now is being held up by Indian bureaucracy. Janha Pradhan remains hopeful and says the community will celebrate with a feast the day those rights come. Pradhan says gaining title to the forest will officially give women equal rights to the land and will ensure that these trees and the bounty they bring are protected for generations to come. For the world, Sam Eaton, Gundurabadi, India.
That forest looks as beautiful as it sounds, but don't take my word for it. See it for yourself. We've got photos on our Tumblr page. That's pritheworld.tumblr.com. And finally today, let me tell you about a smaller group of women from the Asian subcontinent banding together. Sitar player Anushka Shankar and her new musical friend, the Sri Lankan-born rapper M.I.A. This is from Anushka Shankar's CD, Land of Gold, a track with M.I.A. called Jump In, Cross the Line. It's a nod toward migration. This is not the first time M.I.A. has addressed the topic. 2013 saw her release a song, Attention, and last year she recorded Borders about the Mediterranean migration crisis. Jump In, Cross the Line brings M.I.A. a different audience, but the same could be said for Anushka Shankar. After all, she isn't just performing here with M.I.A., Anushka Shankar's sitar is also being souped up with the help of MIA's producer, Blackstar. When I see that dream, I go make it mine. Jump In, Cross the Line, the latest from Anushka Shankar along with MIA. Anushka's new CD, Land of Gold, is out later this week. And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.